Call the hearing back to order. We have the Alpine Group team present now. So, have you got flavours?
All good.
Shall I go first?
Yeah, you go first. Do you
My name is Scott Aker. I'm a resource management planner with Southern Land Limited, and I've been engaged by the Alpine Group to provide expert planning evidence in relation to their submission supporting the proposed district plan's rural industrial subzone and their further submissions in opposition to the submission of Walkerspear Holdings Limited. The following is a summary of my evidence in chief that was pre-launched on 4th of April. The submission of the Alpine Group seeks that the rural industrial subzone and all related provisions are made operative as proposed, while their further submission seeks that the rezoning proposed by Walkerspear Holdings Limited is rejected. I consider that the establishment of the rural industrial subzone and its application to the land currently occupied by the Lovett Sawmill and the Alpine Group's deer velvet and venison processing factory appropriately achieves the higher order provisions of the proposed district plan, particularly the objectives and policies that support and enable rural activities and encourage rural diversification. I therefore consider that the rural industrial subzone should be made operative as proposed. Walkerspear Holdings Limited seeks the rezoning of the land immediately to the north and east of the rural industrial subzone from rural to rural lifestyle. The proposed rezoning would provide for the identification of up to 5 residential building platforms. The Alpine Group opposed the proposed rezoning due to the potential reverse sensitivity effect resulting from the location of residential building platforms in close proximity to the rural industrial subzone. While the objectives and policies of the Rural Residential and Rural Lifestyle Chapter of the proposed district plan acknowledge the effects of rural activities in terms of noise, odour, dust and traffic generation, the noise limits set out in Chapter 36 of the proposed district plan would apply to activities within the rural industrial subzone. Those noise limits apply to the notional boundary of any residential unit. The existing rural residential zone at Luggett is located approximately 85 metres to the south of the proposed rural industrial subzone. However, due to restrictive covenants imposed on the properties adjoining Luggett Creek, the notional boundary of residential units within the rural residential zone is likely to be no closer than 220 metres from the rural industrial subzone. Walkerspear Holdings proposed rural lifestyle zoning would provide for the establishment of residential units up to 10 metres from the boundary of the rural industrial subzone. I therefore consider that the rezoning proposed would make it significantly more difficult for activities within the subzone to comply with the proposed district plan's noise limits. While it could be scoped to register covenants on the rural lifestyle lots created at the time of subdivision, I consider that in this case it is more appropriate to address reverse sensitivity effects at the time the land is rezoned in order that the necessity for reverse sensitivity covenants is not missed or challenged at the time of subdivision. I therefore consider that the proposed rural lifestyle zoning has the potential to result in significant adverse reverse sensitivity effects on activities within the subzone, and on that basis I consider that Walkerton Holdings' proposed rural lifestyle zoning should be rejected unless the potential reverse sensitivity effect can be addressed prior to rezoning being made popular.
Really, just to make this clear, you talked about the Alpine Group's de-development and venison processing factory. Is that on a different site to the sawmill, or is it on the same site? Or
originally it was the same lot. There's three lots all part of the same. The sawmill's on two lots, or one lot, actually, lot two. The venison factory is on lot three, and the timber stacking yard is on lot two. They're all part of the same area.
Just for my record, Scott introduced mentioned your name, but yes,
Jonathan Wallace.
Jonathan Wallace. And what's the configuration of the plant like? I'm looking at the railroad zone. So you have a
both the mill and the venison factory are located close to Church Road, and then the yard is behind, if you like.
Right.
The venison factory was established in 1963, and the mill was late 50s.
We have an energy shortage.
We have an
energy
shortage.
So, you said the venison factory was established in the 60s?
Yeah, early 60s.
And the sawmill in the...
I'd have to check with my father, but I think it was in the 50s. And the venison factory was subdivided off when the mill was sold from the family company to Carter Holt Harbour, or what was Carter's at the time.
Now, one of the things about reverse sensitivity issues is that unlike most situations when you're applying consent, you've actually got to talk about the adverse effects that your operations have. Now, I know that sawmills are notoriously noisy, but I've acted for some sawmills before. What are venison processing factories like? Does it smell?
No, we're heavily regulated in that sense, both from a ORC perspective, but also from a national or central government perspective, being a an export plant.
It's not like a freezing works.
No. Even a freezing works now, you smell odour and noise and things.
I can remember growing up in Invercargill, standing at the front door and smelling lawnmill about 10 kilometres away.
That's right. That'd be the rendering plant that you can smell. That's right. Yeah.
And pose a question for either of you. How noisy is the sawmill? How much noise does it generate?
We're currently the sawmill's neighbour. We don't have an issue with the noise as such. The intention in the short to medium term is that the mill will cease operation. It's currently owned separately, and we're under contract now to purchase.
suppose, Mr. Edgar, that's not an encouraging basis to apply hard reverse sensitivity limits if the venison factory doesn't has no odour and the sawmill's going to close down.
It's more around the looking at the proposed new rules associated with the rural industrial subzone. I think that there was no submissions against the concept of a rural industrial subzone, something that the district is certainly lacking. It was more looking at the proposed rules in there around building heights and those sorts of things, that it is industrial.
So you think that once you've got some residential neighbours,
correct,
they'll find something to complain about?
Yeah, I think at the moment there's definitely a need, you know, for that zone. In essence, what happens is you have rural industrial activities being conducted by way of consent in the rural zone. What this proposes is to say, well, as of right, within a certain set of rules, that you can carry out activities.
And I suppose while the sawmill may or may not be closed down in the future, there's always the potential that something similar may seek to locate within the subzone, whether it be a firewood operation or something else that has similar effects to the sawmill.
And the effects will be noise and sawdust.
And vehicle movements.
And, Speaker, I suppose the... I know that the submission you're supporting is don't rezone it, but the nature of the arguments you're presenting that Mr. Wallace is echoing shrieks out setbacks to me. Well, certainly as an alternative, if you're looking at a Section 32 basis.
Yeah, I think it may be difficult to address noise through a setback. Whether there's enough scope within the land proposed to be rezoned to set back building platforms far enough that noise isn't an issue or doesn't become an issue, it's hard to say. I'm not really sure what other mechanism there could be through the district plan review to address those effects. But my understanding is that if reverse sensitivity effects can be addressed, then the Alpine Group aren't opposed to this rezoning.
Not at all.
Okay. I suppose the obvious comment is that you haven't given us a lot of technical basis for deciding how big a problem it is and how far they would need to set back.
Mm.
Is it, but like your analysis is that although the rural residential land on the Luggett side is close, it's not as close as it appears because of the covenants on the land.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, there's in between there's the Luggett Creek, which has a marginal strip as well as a reserve as well.
Yeah. I have a copy of the covenant areas.
That would be a good start, please.
So on these lots, buildings can only be built right up by the road. on the end of Paris Place. So measuring from the Beer Belt factory to 20 metres from the edge of the Covenant area.
Okay. Steve, I think we are up to exhibit 35. Yes, please. Just a second. Any questions?
Good afternoon. Ms. Walden, my question is probably more for you than Mr. Eager. I just want to be clear that I understand what you have said in relation to the chair's question, and that is in relation to the existing operation of both the sauna and the factory. So, can you just confirm which activity is under contract for, say, back to you?
Sawmill.
So the sawmill under contract back to you?
Correct.
But your current plans, and of course they could change, are that the sawmill would cease operation?
Correct. We're not in the business of milling trees, no.
Okay. And at the moment you're exploring other possibilities for that land?
Correct.
Yeah. And venison business, that is to continue?
Correct.
What's the current status? Is it sort of plateaued out?
No, currently we operate through three different locations in New Zealand, and the intention would be over time to potentially consolidate that. We're not... it's not meat processing as such, it's mostly nutraceuticals. So,
what does that mean?
Traditional Chinese medicine. Yeah. So we take products from primary processors and further process them at that site.
Okay. Is this like Deer Valley?
Correct, yeah.
So does that involve specialised equipment?
Or? Yes, it does, yeah. Yeah. Inside, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, currently in the plant there's things like vacuum dryers, freeze dryers, milling machines, all sorts. Yeah.
So when you say consolidate, I mean, some of this, I don't, if it's commercially sensitive, I'm not asking you to divulge anything that may be, but I'd just like to get a feel for whether or not the rural industrial subzone that you occupy is going to continue with some form of activity in the future, or whether you're going to...
Currently we occupy rural general zone, and it's under the proposed district plan that the area becomes a rural industrial subzone.
Yes.
The recognition was that this was an area that was already industrial, if you like, within the rural zone, and obviously if we want to change what we do or to expand, currently that requires to go through the resource consent process if we move outside of our parameters that we are at the moment. And also acknowledges that there's others too that you know, have these types of activity, whether it be grading of cherries or dried fruits or things like that. Firewood is another one that often becomes a bit of a red herring in a rural general zone. So it's to create an area that could accommodate these types of activities.
It's not directly on point in relation to your further submission, but I'd still like to understand whether the consent that you have, or whether the, I should turn it around the other way, whether the proposed rural industrial subzone provides an adequate envelope for your existing operation and any consent conditions, i.e. if you're, you know, are your consented noise limits the same or similar to what would apply in the subzone?
What the rural industrial subzone does is allow for a range of different activities within there.
Yeah.
It doesn't deal with matters like odour, because that's a regional council matter.
Isn't the noise, I think, is covered district, isn't it?
Regional
as well?
No, it's covered in the
district.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think at the moment, looking at the types of activities that are there, if you said a sawmill, I think that would be at one end of the scale in terms of noise. There's unlikely to be industrial activities that would exceed that. But that's a consented permitted activity at the moment.
Yeah. Well, just to put that to you, Mr. Edgar, if you know, does the rural industrial subzone set the same or similar noise level to the consented noise level for the sawmill?
I think the sawmill, as far as I'm aware, will be operating under existing use rates. So in that sense, there probably isn't a condition of consent limiting noise. I think the noise limit under the proposed district plan and the rural zone would be lower than you could generally expect to occur with a sawmill operation.
Okay. And what hours are both businesses operating at the moment?
At the moment, the Venison plant operates 24 hours. It's just the nature of some of the equipment that's used there. And depending on the season, so sometimes you're packing at night. Other than a car parked outside, you wouldn't know that it's operational.
Yeah. And that's over 7 days?
Depending on the season. Some in the peak season, it's 7 days a week. Yeah.
And what about the sawmill?
The sawmill, I think, at the moment is operating 5 days a week, including the firewood operation, which the tenant has at the back of the shop.
So that's weekday as opposed to including the
tenant? Yeah.
Just a point of clarification, your point, Mr. Egan, the noise levels lower than we generally expect from a sawmill, that's assuming there is a nearby notional.
Yeah.
So that's if there were a nearby notional mountain,
yeah, correct.
That there would definitely be a problem.
Yeah.
There's currently not a
question with that.
I have no further questions.
Likewise. Any final thoughts?
I think Mr. Wallace would like to speak to the rest of the Alpine Group submission.
Just the one on landscapes, if I may.
Yeah, news to us, but carry on, and we'll work it out as we go along.
Yeah. So, Jonathan Wallace from the Alpine Group. I am managing director of the Alpine Group, which has interest in pasture farming, aviation, tourism, and primary exports. In terms of landscapes, I categorically support the inclusion of rural landscape classification and also support the intent behind outstanding natural landscapes. However, we specifically reject that ONL should be applied in areas that would be more suitable to a comprehensive and systematic application of rural landscape classification. All farms have areas that are more developed and more suitable to development than others. Typically, this follows natural contours at the base of the main hills on flat and rolling areas and includes areas that are intensively farmed and modified from the unimproved landscape. These areas include areas of fences and roads, as well as yards and buildings. the land is more suited to appropriate development than others and should therefore be included in the rural landscape classification. Subdivision and development are not inappropriate in all locations, in which is currently proposed under Astounding Natural Landscape, meaning that RLC, Rural Landscape Classification, would be better suited taking into account that subdivision development is inappropriate in many locations within these landscapes as opposed to all locations. I guess what I'm trying to say is that it appears that RLC has been applied to some extent in some areas, but there's been an arbitrary stop to that beyond the lake. And it seems to go to contradict the purpose of the landscape or the zoning by then imposing ONL arbitrary over all that land. I think it's fair to say that there are some areas that just don't fit the minimum size criteria for the landscape lines, and my understanding of that, but that's a 1 kilometre by 2 kilometre rectangle. But there are large areas which are developed that would better suit being classified as rural landscape classification.
Call a spade a spade. Where are we talking about?
Well, for us, we live on the western side of Lake Wanaka, north of Minaret Creek and south of the Albert. It's at Minaret Station. It's a heavily modified landscape on the side of the lake. It runs 27 kilometres around the side of the lake. And we fundamentally support the concept of astounding natural landscapes, but it would be somewhat nugatory to avoid the use of rural landscape classification, which is a new landscape classification. We support it.
I understand your frustration. No further questions.
I have no questions. I understand where you're coming from. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you all for your contributions.
Thank you for your time.
Name you gave to herbal medicine, what was it?
What's that, sorry?
The name you gave for processing herbal developed herbal?
Nutraceuticals, or TCM, which is traditional Chinese medicine.
Nutraceuticals?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have, in the Western world, we term them as pharmaceuticals. In Asia, they tend to be termed as nutraceuticals.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Todd, you can further step forward with your first set of clients.
Sorry?
You can step forward with your first set. Well,
I'll stop here, but I do have this easy.
I'm appearing on behalf of James Wilson Cooper, who, for your information, owns a approximately 3,200 hectares of land, which is bounded by the Hawea River to the west, the Clutha River to the south, Kane Road to the east, and roughly Camp Hill Road to the north, although they also own some land on the northern side of Camp Hill Road. Mr. Cooper, through his company known as Devon Dairy Limited, is developing that property into seven dairy platforms, and I think at the last count, when fully developed, there'll be about 5,000 cows will be farmed and milked on that property. Mr. Cooper's interest in respect to the district plan has primarily been to ensure that the outstanding natural landscape line north of the Clutha River, and the Clutha River terraces, is in the right location, the correct location. And he also had an issue around a significant natural area, but no evidence is going to be called on that matter. The issue of the outstanding natural landscape has raised its head in the past when he has been attempting to develop part of the property as one of the dairy platforms, and necessitated the planting around a milking shed of native trees, because the milking shed was going to be located in the what the council had deemed, at the time, the council's landscape architect had deemed to be an outstanding natural landscape. You can imagine the practical difficulties of planting native plants around a milking shed might bring. And hence, Mr. Cooper was motivated when he saw the planning maps to have us instruct Mr. Espy to prepare a brief of evidence. First of all, to look at the location of the landscape lines, which had been suggested in the notified plans, and then make submission, and then hence, of course, that evidence now present.
So, clarified position, Mr. Todd, you said there's an issue in the submission, taken in the submission about an SNA. You're not calling any evidence, but you are maintaining the submission?
We've maintained the position primarily because of the factual situation that by the time the SNA had been identified, that area had already been extensively farmed and irrigated. We just don't think it's pointless taking the matter any further.
So there's nothing left to clear.
Sorry?
Nothing left to clear, so the...
Correct. Nothing left to protect.
And therefore no practical impediment on farming operations.
Yes.
Over to you, Mr. Todd, but I would have thought that, given the landscape focus, we should perhaps hear Mr. Espy's evidence, and
yes,
I come back here with any residual questions.
It's an expert situation, it's not an issue for legal submissions, to be honest.
Mr. Espy, how do you want to proceed? Do you have a summary?
I don't have a written summary, Commissioners. Obviously, you've got my brief. What I thought might be most useful is if I just quickly, particularly through the appendices to that, because they sort of explain the situation quite quickly, and then maybe take you through my executive summary or conclusion part of my evidence.
Yes, that would be helpful, thank you.
If you go to my appendices, the first appendix is quite a big one, which is a report. So appendix one is a report that I prepared in 2011 to do with landscape categorisation of the Cooper property. I won't talk to that, but then flip over to my Appendix 2. Appendix 2 is an A3 plan, and that shows the proposed district plan landscape categorisation lines. So you can see there's this broad corridor around the Clutha River that is on the south side of the Cooper property. That corridor is marked in the proposed district plan to be ONF. Is between 1.1 and 1.3 kilometres wide, and that goes up onto the Cooper property. So then if we flip over to my Appendix 3.
Can you just hold off a second?
Sorry?
The corridor you're measuring is between 1.1 and 1.3 kilometres.
Yes.
Correct. That's fine. Thank you, sir.
Well, there were two appendix twos, I think.
Oh, sorry.
I was looking at bill for consented residential development.
Oh, sorry. It is a bit confusing. That's appendix two to my report, and that report is appendix one.
So the correct the appendix two you're referring to is part of Dr. Marion Green's landscape categorisation line.
That's right. Which I know of. So that's Dr. Marion Lee's landscape categorisation lines that we've been adopted as part of the proposed district plan.
Yep.
Appendix 3 is Ms. Anne Stephen's landscape categorisation line. Now, Ms. Anne Stephen was a landscape architect who was engaged to do a peer review of Marion Reed's categorisation. So on Appendix 3 I've shown Ms. Stephen's landscape category lines. And then if we flip over to Appendix 4, we've got Helen Melsop's landscape categorisation lines. Now, Helen Melsop was the council landscape architect who was engaged to report on submissions. So the line shown on Appendix 4 is Ms. Melsop's line. And then if we flip over to Appendix 5, we'll see my line. And the main difference, of course, is that I'm saying, well, the Clutha River and its immediate corridor are legitimately an ONF, but the terraces, these broad terrace faces, brick terrace trees really, outside that immediate corridor are more correctly categorised simply as part of the surrounding landscape, which is a rural landscape, category landscape. And if we go over to Appendix, just for completeness, Appendix 6 is a landscape categorisation line that Dr. Reed did in relation to a resource consent in 2013, which shows a slightly different situation here. And then going over to Appendix 7, Appendix 7 shows a number of farm improvements on the Cooper property, including in particular shown there in yellow the various standard pivot irrigators. And so the ones that are called block 2 and block 9 are on these terraced treads that the proposed district planning categorises as outstanding national landscape. So that's Appendix 7. Appendix 8 are a number of photos of these treads. I won't take you through those individually, but they're referred to in the text. So perhaps most usefully, if we go to my paragraph 3.1, which is my executive summary on page 3, I say then, Ms. Melsop considers that the lower terrace lands within the Cooper land holding are part of a wide Clutha River corridor landscape that is an outstanding natural landscape. I consider that the Clutha River itself is an outstanding natural feature, but the terrace lands on the north side are not particularly natural or outstanding, and are most correctly categorised as part of the broad surrounding landscape that continues to the north, which, while pleasant and of a rural character, is not an outstanding natural landscape. And just maybe round off, we go to my conclusion section of my ordinance, which is Section 7, so paragraph 7.1 on page 10 of my evidence. I confirm The opinion arrived at my 2011 report, and that's the report that that is appendix one, that no part of the Cooper landholding is within an outstanding natural landscape or outstanding natural feature. Farming developments that have occurred since 2011, so since I wrote that report, mean that the terrace lands within the Cooper landholding are now even more modified and less natural than previously. And then 7.3, Ms. Malsoff's identified river corridor RNL is too wide to be an outstanding natural feature and too narrow to be an outstanding natural landscape. The terrace lands are most logically categorised as part of the surrounding landscape, which is not an outstanding natural landscape. So, happy to answer any questions on that, commissioners, or go to any parts that you would like to explain.
Mr. Chairman, just for reference point, if you turn to Appendix 7, which Mr. Espy just took you to, you'll see there the location of the dairy shed, the milking shed that I referred to, and that which caused the problem in the past, and you'll see that that is shown being within Dr. Reed's ONL in Appendix 2.
That's the shed on Block 2?
Yes.
I should tell you, Mr. Todd, that we were taken past the dairy shed. It's a very fetching dairy shed as dairy sheds go.
Yes.
But now, Mr. Espy, I should tell you, by way of background, that when Dr. Reed gave evidence the first week of this hearing, I asked her about the inconsistency that you had identified, and her answer, paraphrasing it, you can go back and listen to the tape if you feel the need, was in essence, yes, there was an inconsistency, but that the rationale was that she agreed with you that the feature was to the top of the lowest banks, but there was nevertheless an outstanding natural landscape that of which the feature formed part to the, from terrace to terrace. And so I'm not inviting necessarily any comment, but I think you should be aware of that. If you or Mr. Todd want to make comment or submissions respectfully, you're open to do that.
Yes, well, that's what I understand Ms. Malsoff to be saying as well. Although in the notified proposed district plan, that whole wide corridor is identified as an outstanding natural feature.
Now, the next point between you, and this may be more Mr. Todd's sphere, I asked the council legal team whether there was a scope issue swapping what is identified in the proposed plan from being an ONF to an ONL, if they cover the same land. Do you have any comment or submissions you'd wish to make on that one, Mr. Todd?
I haven't previously given that any thought, to be honest. Quite clearly, if you go back to the Washington Environmental series of cases, which provided the foundation for the need to identify, the need for councils at the time of preparation of a plan to identify, the obligation to identify outstanding natural features and natural, outstanding natural landscapes. I wouldn't have thought that differentiating between the two would have caused you any major problem, because it was statutory. There's a statutory obligation for you to identify them. That's as far as because I haven't considered that issue any deeper than that. That's really all I can offer.
Well, I suppose having thrown that curveball at you, do you want time to respond to it, or are you happy to leave it there?
I'm happy to leave it there. because for the purpose of our submission, it doesn't make any difference.
Yes, that point had occurred to me. Now, excuse me. My understanding of the reason for the difference of in view between your opinion and the opinion that Dr. Reed and more particularly Ms. Malsop have identified is that they put considerable emphasis on the visibility of the geomorphological, that's probably not the word, of the river terraces up to the top, and you say that you don't regard them as distinct from the surrounding landscape. And I just have a, first of all, is that accord with your view as to the fundamental difference between? Or is it
yes,
something that I've missed?
Well, yes, I think that's the main difference, yes. Ms. Malsop and Dr. Reed have taken this view that the feature of the Clutha River corridor, whether you call it the feature of landscape, they've taken the view that it takes in all of the land on either side of the river as far as the highest terrace. And that highest terrace is legible in the landscape. You can certainly see it, no doubt about that. But I consider that that's just casting the net too widely. If you're going to identify a feature that is outstanding and natural, it has to be cohesively outstanding and natural. And the thing that is really the feature here is the river. If you kept going beyond that terrace, you could keep going and going and find legible geomorphological patterns in the landscape that are connected with the Clutha River. But in my opinion, you'd just be going well beyond what is the feature of the river corridor. After all, the terrace itself, the terrace riser is legible. And it's legible because it's different to the flat land. It doesn't mean it's more natural than the flat land. It's not. All of this land is created by natural processes. You can simply see it, that's all.
Could I just ask you to repeat, you said your test was, it was cohesive, and you said something else which I didn't have time to write down.
Yes, I'm not sure. I'm saying the feature, if you're identifying a feature, that feature must be identifiable, recognisable as an outstanding natural feature. I think if you start blurring the edges out and out and out, you lose the feature.
And I think, to be fair, Ms. Malsop, and indeed Dr. Reed, agree with you on that point, which is why they've focused on those as a landscape.
Yes, well, I suppose that's why they have done that. Well, I think the point there really is once you're beyond the corridor feature, you're part of the broader landscape. There's no point in saying there's a narrow landscape that sits inside the broader landscape. The broader landscape is the broader landscape. It's a farming landscape. It's the floor of the Upper Clutha Basin. And it's a very pleasant landscape, but it's not an outstanding natural landscape.
Can you give us an example somewhere else in the district of a series of terraces such as we're talking about here that haven't been identified as an outstanding landscape?
While there are some that were discussed at the time of these reports being prepared by Dr. Reid and then peer reviewed by Ian Stephen and then going to the post-district plan, which are further to the south east of here, near the Red Bridge on the cliff and near Lake, on the north side of the river, I'm thinking of. Yeah, so those ones were are not included as being part of our scenic natural feature. Another example that Mr. Toss has pointed out in the Waka Tipperary are the terraces, very legible terraces, quite similar to this actually, where the shot over passes beside Domain Road. And there's a terrace riser, and terrace is quite similar to this, and they are not included in the outstanding natural feature of the shop. I'm sure there are plenty others as well, if that was to be examined.
Mm. And in terms of the point that you made about this not being big enough to constitute a landscape, I wanted to give you the opportunity to comment because I went back and read that case, and it said for flat landscapes here are some rules of thumb to identify a separate landscape, and I would have thought that whatever else this landscape was, it's not flat.
Well, that's correct, yeah. I mean, I do think that those criteria given in that decision are pretty loose, and I wouldn't hang my hat on those as to what defines a landscape and what doesn't. I mean, it was intended to be a bit of guidance, I think. But I think the real point here is that when you're drawing a line between two landscapes, there has to be some recognisable change of character on either side of the line. If it's the same on either side of the line, then why draw a line? And that's essentially what I'm saying. There's a river that passes through a farming landscape. How wide is the feature? Well, it's as wide as the river.
The devil's advocate response might be that going to the highest terrace there is a change of character, because above the highest terrace it then goes back several kilometres, which is the bulk of the Dairy's land.
And beyond.
Through Hawea Flat, and in fact the entire Hawea Flats.
Correct.
And so that's the devil's advocate question. And I admit freely to you that I've been personally wrestling with this, because I've been up on the top of Mount Iron, where, as you say, those terraces are very visible, but I've also driven through the land, and as Mr. Todd submitted, it's intensively farmed land, complete with, as I say, a carefully landscaped milking shed.
Yeah, well, that's correct. I mean, I don't disagree that terrace riser is legible. I just say that the character on either side of that terrace riser is the same. It's all intensively farmed land, and if we were to identify an outstanding natural feature for the Clutha River, it really should be the feature of the Clutha River. After all, if we go beyond this terrace riser off into the landscape, we come across various little pieces of geomorphological feature that are really identifiable as a terrace or as a remnant piece of rounded bedrock from glaciation, or there's all sorts of identifiable features there, but they're part of the broader landscape.
Mm.
They're correctly considered as part of the landscape.
Commissioner Hudson.
Yeah, good afternoon, the one question that is still sticking in my mind is at what point does a landscape that has been identified as outstanding ceases to be as a result of a change in the land use? Here there is, as you pointed out, a farming operation that's, as we, in front of our eyes, is transforming the land and has transformed the land. But does it mean that the landscape has ceased to be an outstanding natural landscape? Now, I'm sure, I know that this has come up in various environmental cases, but I just need to hear your response in relation to this particular situation.
Yeah, well, I think, looking at development of landscapes over time, obviously there was a time in the past where none of this landscape was modified by humans really at all. Well, it really wasn't. I mean, progressively it's been modified to the degree that we see on the ground today. And so we have to accept that there are areas of land that may well have been outstanding and natural in the past and they no longer are. I guess the categorisation process that gets done as part of a district plan review or as the formulation of a district plan has to be done at a very broad scale. And I think you have to look on the ground and think, if we're going to place a boundary between two landscapes, where should we place it? Well, I can't see any point, as I said, in placing it in a location where the character on one side of the land is of the line is the same as the character on the other side of the line. The line really should be a line of change from one landscape to another landscape. And if you do this at a broad scale, that can be done, but I just don't see that you draw the lines where the proposed district plan is drawn. This landscape has a homogenous character that is to do with relatively intensive farming. On the south side of the Clutha in this corridor, it's even subdivided into lifestyle blocks, which are, as they become developed, will be even more intensively used. And so I think these lines are not a line that marks a change from one landscape to another. There's this relatively homogenous landscape with the outstanding natural feature of the Clutha corridor running through it. And I guess we need to take account of what the district plan allows people to do. And of course, on these blocks that are to the south of the river, these are lifestyle blocks. People can't do anything they want, but they can do things in accordance with what has been the rural general zone and is going to be the rural zone. There's no point ignoring activities that will occur or are permitted to occur, as long as farming activity has been.
Commissioner, could I just interrupt and just seek a point of clarification? I'm looking at your appendix 2, which is, I think, effectively the notified lines. I had understood, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the area to the south is at the top of the ridge line opposite Devon Dairies, and I don't know if it's the same contour, but it certainly stepped back from the lowest terrace immediately above the river. So I wonder if you could clarify that for me. Is my understanding correct? Is that not the equivalent terrace on the other side?
Yes, in my understanding, it's the equivalent terrace on the other side. So the line on the south side of the river is at the top of an escarpment. If you go to the north of that line, you go onto a flat terrace area, which is now in these lifestyle blocks, I think 10 hectares or thereabouts. And then at the north end of those, is the escarpment down to the Clutha River corridor itself. So the blue line is at the top of the escarpment, that is some distance to the south of the river.
And where are the landscape community? In that case, where are you? Where are the landscape lifestyle blocks that you're talking about?
Well, the ones I'm talking about are to the north of that line, so within the corridor. You can see the property boundary.
So it's been subdivided, but it's within the corridor?
Yes.
Or with a defined O&L?
Yes.
Sorry, Commissioner. Just got to understand that before you carry on. Commissioner McLeod.
Yeah, just the Newcastle track, which was down here, is I'd be frequenting that weekly. Often, more often if I wasn't sitting in the seat, it has to be said. And if you actually, there's parts of that track when you obviously see the dairy farm, and I would probably go as far as to say that is probably the most intensified piece of farming that this area has probably seen ever since the blocks were first chopped up. And you can find yourself not even noticing that. And as you're passing through that landscape, the feature, which is again referring to your appendix 2, that you're looking at, you're obviously looking at the Clutha River because it's stunning, but it's the banks on both sides, and it does put that backdrop to it, which defines the landscape area that you're in. And I mean, obviously you've been down there it'd be really interesting to hear from you why you've then decided that it's hard on the river, if you have it hard. Because that red line would effectively be the track, top of the escarpment on the Clutha River.
Yeah, well, that would be the top of the escarpment that's immediately adjacent to the track.
Yeah. So in actuality, you're probably, the track goes in and out.
Yeah, the track probably goes in and out. Yeah. Some parts of the track sort of at the bottom of the escarpment, some parts it goes up the escarpment.
Yeah.
So that's and so when you're on that track, particularly if you look to the south, obviously there's some really dramatic sort of eroded banks and what have you. That immediate corridor of the Clutha, I would say, would be the outstanding natural feature. But even to the north of my red line there, obviously we're not in a situation here where we're drawing the line between zones or something like that. You know, nobody's saying that the lands in the north of this red line can be intensively developed or can be built or anything like that. It's still going to be rural zone. It's still going to have to meet a lot of criteria and objectives and policies to do with landscape protection. I don't think we have to call everything an O&L if we want to retain the amenity of it. We don't. I'm certainly not saying that land, even though it's intensively farmed, has no visual amenity value or landscape value. It does.
And the other thing would be, given that, as you can see from the placement of the pivots in Appendix 7, that is operating and functioning. We toured the farm, and it is operating and functioning given within an O&L, and I'll give you that. There might have been a bit of planting, but there was also, if I remember, there was a pig unit next to that as well. You know, so it doesn't seem that the operation of that within the O&L doesn't seem to curtail the operation of the farm.
That's not correct. Can I address that from experience?
Please do.
Direct experience. The resource, the costs from a regulatory point of view to establish the dairy shed in an O&L, the dairy shed being a truly rural activity, was in excess of $100,000. And if you say that that's not constraining farming, then I would have to take serious issue with that. A dairy shed. We're not talking about a house. We're talking about an activity that one would expect to see in a rural zone, That's what cost to establish it there.
And can I ask you, in your experience, to tell us what would that same dairy farm have cost to do to outside of the ONL but in a rural zone? You'd still have to
establish it.
You'd still have to go through.
Oh, significantly less than that. Yeah. Significantly less than that. For example, to establish a pivot doesn't cost anything because of the change in the definition of what pivots were. Previously, we had to get resource consents to establish pivots on this property. We don't have to do that anymore because they're not deemed to be buildings.
Buildings, yeah.
Yeah.
And ultimately, Mr. Todd, presumably you would agree that in the light of Man of War, while it's while we're charged with assessing costs and benefits for fixing O&L lines, it's peculiarly a landscape assessment rather than an assessment of the consequences of, which I think Mr. Espy already made, a point Mr. Espy already makes. So while I understand you're responding to the Commissioner's questions, question is that in fact a red herring?
Well, no, I don't think it is, because you've got to remember that the underlying zoning here is rural. If you want to have an amenity zone, why don't we be honest and call it an amenity zone and do something totally different? But you're calling it a rural zone, and then you're putting these overlays over it, and you're saying, well, it doesn't really matter if it's an O&L or it's not an O&L. Well, it does matter, and the farmers of this district will tell you that it does cause significant inconvenience to them to carry out legitimate activities, legitimate to the zone, in the areas which are subject to an O&L classification. And this was the very reason we're sitting here today, was the problems we had with establishing that dairy platform in that O&L.
I interrupted your question.
No, it's all good. All good. Thank you for the clarification.
And
when we had advice at the time from Mr. Espy saying it wasn't an O&L, that was the frustration.
Now, a question for Mr. Espy, arising out of first Appendix 1. Appendix 1 to Appendix 1. This plan shows the Devon Dairies land. There is a factor. There's a blue outline showing the extent of sites that have been found to be entirely of visual amenity landscape status, which includes the area the south of the river that we were talking about. Can you provide me the case that found that?
Yes, I can do. I have to get the reference, but the explanation there, sir, is that that Appendix 1 to Appendix 1 was prepared in 2011 prior to the council notifying any landscape lines to do with the proposed district plan. And
I suppose that, the key question is, was it the Environment Court that found that it was a vow, or was it a council hearing?
Well, that area that's got the blue line around it there to the south of the river was a proposed subdivision called the Poplar Beach subdivision.
So north that
Poplar Beach. And when that was proposed, it was proposed by way of resource consent application, and the applicants and the council processing reports agreed that the site was in a visual amenity landscape and not an outstanding natural landscape or an outstanding natural feature. And it was granted resource consent on that basis. Now, from memory, that went through without any Environment Court input. There was no appeals. So it was settled at council level.
Thank you for that. No, I don't need the reference to, like, if it was... It was an Environment Court decision. I would have been very interested to read it, but I understand the point. And I just want to make sure I have no other questions for you.
That was all I had. Thank you very much. You'll adjourn the hearing for afternoon tea. You'll come back at, say, 5 to 4 to hear the Glendine team retire.